You're listening to Consider This on KZYX. My name is Stuart Campbell, and I welcome you to the program. We're on the web at considerthis.us, where you can sign up to receive email updates about future programs. We're also on the KZYX website, and you can get information about future, current, and past programs and listen to or download podcasts of past shows at both locations. You can call us here in the studio a little later on in the program at 707-895-2448. Or you can send your comments or questions at any time to dj@kzyx.org. My guest on this program is Mark Rowlands, University of Miami professor of philosophy, author of 17 books. His most recent is Memory and the Self, Phenomenology, Science, and Autobiography, in which he argues for a novel conception of memory that plays a central role in explaining how our memories make us who we are. Mark Rowlands, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Stuart. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So this book is a philosophical argument for a view of memory and self, and it draws on analytic philosophy, phenomenology, science, psychology, literature, kind of a multidisciplinary approach. Would you please start by setting that stage of the materials that you draw on in many areas in taking on this issue?
Yes. I mean, I suppose... The task I set myself, the whole book was motivated by a kind of puzzle, you know, and the puzzle was, it's plausible to think that our memories make us who we are, you know, I mean, what could make us the people we are if not the the experiences we've had, you know, in the course of our lives, and how do we retain those experiences if not through memories of certain sorts. So I think that's a sort of intuitively natural idea that can be expressed in different ways, both in philosophy, literature, and other fields. But this sort of intuitively natural idea sort of runs into a couple of problems. The first is, you know, we forget virtually everything. I mean, we've all forgotten far more than we remember. So if you imagine, you know, you as like a sort of book, you know, the book of you, your autobiography, and you think of yourself as writing this sort of book, and you open up the pages, and the vast majority of sentences that were in the book have been redacted. That's the first problem, the problem of forgetting. And the second problem is that the things we remember are often they often bear very little resemblance to the things that actually happened to us and the experiences we actually had at the time. This has been the subject of, you know, fairly extensive experimental confirmation. So if you go back to the idea of the book, not only are most of the sentences redacted, the ones that remain are in various ways sort of misleading, and some of them are just downright false. So then the question is, well, how can memories make us who we are under those sorts of conditions?
So let's delve into that just a little bit more. I know there's evidence of memory loss and forgetting and even confabulation, but it seems to me that people kind of, maybe naively, and we just tend to live like our memories are far more accurate than the evidence really suggests that they are. So could you get into a little bit more of the evidence of that and try to undermine this kind of common sense notion that, you know, we just remember our experiences, and that's what makes us who we are, and that's that.
Yeah, sure. It used to be thought, right, that, okay, the people acknowledged that the memories could be in various shades, you know, inaccurate, but it was often thought that there were some memories that were so sort of vivid and striking that you always remember these accurately. These are so-called flashbulb memories, the memories you have of where you were when, you know, JFK was assassinated and things like that. But the idea that these sorts of memories, even these sorts of memories, are particularly accurate was undermined by a sort of classic study by Ulrich Neisser and his student Nicole Harsh. This was a study that pertained to the Challenger explosion in 86. And what Neisser and Harsh did was collect together a group of students on the Emory campus in Atlanta and ask them to write down in detail what they were doing when they heard that the Challenger had exploded. And then they rounded them up, those they could anyway, a few years later, and again got them to write down what they were doing when the Challenger exploded. And the sort of the accounts were very sort of divergent, you know. There was some were reasonably accurate, some were wildly divergent, and that sort of study is a kind of typical kind of study that psychologists will now do. They'll find some sort of notable event. Earthquakes in California are a very, very common one, and then they will round up some students and over a period of several years get them to write down their accounts of what they were doing when these things happened. And it seems, you know, the evidence seems fairly consistent that these accounts often diverge wildly.
And there's another common issue these days in our understanding of memory, and particularly as it relates to the self, and that in addition to the kind of inaccuracies that get introduced into our memories and even the confabulations that get introduced into our memories, and that's things like Alzheimer's later on in life. And yet, even in those cases, or at least it raises the question there, where it's maybe more pronounced, of what is the relationship of those memories and that loss of memory to the self?
Yeah, no, it does raise a lot of interesting questions. One of the things, there were several things actually, but one of the things that got me starting thinking about this sort of the thing that eventually turned into the book was my wife's grandfather, Patsy, who was a very interesting man. He had very little formal education. He was an Irish laborer who wandered around the UK for much of his early life working in the shipyards. But he was sort of an autodidact. Taught himself. He read a lot of books, and he had lots of fascinating stories to tell. And towards the end of his life, perhaps he got Alzheimer's, and it, you know, as it does, he gradually deteriorated. But there was a strong sort of sense that I got that even though his memories were largely gone, I mean, towards the end of his life, he couldn't even remember who the closest members of his family were. Even though that sort of most of his memories had gone, there was still a very strong sense I had that there was still Patsy Hassett there, and so that got me thinking. Well, okay, perhaps it's not just memories that make us who we are. Perhaps there's something else, or perhaps something happens to memories; they don't just disappear. Maybe something else happens to them, and that was one of the things that started me along the sort of the line of thought that ended up as the book.
So let's get into one, I think, a crucial distinction that you introduce here, and it's one that's maybe not paid attention to very much in common thinking and perhaps even in philosophy so much, is a distinction between the content of memory, which people typically just relate as their experiences, and the act of remembering.
Yes, yeah. That's right. I mean, the problems I describe with forgetting and the falsity of memories, these are all problems of content. You know, the content of the memory, what you remember, is either gone or it's been altered in various sort of significant ways. The Bohemian poet, he wrote in German, Rainer Maria Rilke. In his only excursion into the art form of the novel, actually, he wrote a novel called The Notebooks of Malta Lawrence Brigg. And he had a lovely passage in there which sort of got me thinking. And Rilke wrote, "And yet it's not enough to have memories. You must be able to forget them when they're many, and you must have the immense patience to wait until they return. Mm. The memories themselves are not important. Only when they've changed into our very blood, in the glance and gesture, and are nameless, no longer to be distinguished from ourselves, only then can it happen that in some very rare hour, the first word of a poem arises in their midst and goes forth from them." So Rilke was talking about a certain transformation that memories undergo. He was thinking of this in the context of poetic composition, but I think it has more sort of general significance. So the general idea is we start off with memories, but these memories go, but they don't vanish completely. They turn into something else. And you know, he described that as changing into our blood, into glance and gesture, nameless, and no longer to be distinguished from who we are. And part of what's going on in the book is a sort of philosophical exploration of what it is for a memory to change into blood, glance, and gesture. So I call these sort of memories, or this sort of transformation that memories undergo, I call these Rilkean memories, you know, for obvious reasons.
And how does that relate to this distinction between the content and the act? Certainly the content can change. What happens to that?
Well, in a Rilkean memory, the idea is that the content vanishes, but the act of remembering lives on in a new form. It's no longer an act of remembering as such, but it is transformed into something else. I sort of distinguish two different types of thing it could transform into. One is certain kind of bodily or behavioral tendencies or dispositions, and the other is certain sorts of moods or other kind of affective states. But the general idea is that the act of remembering lives on when the content is, even though the content is gone. But it doesn't live on as an act of remembering as such, but as something else.
Okay, well, we need to get into just that. You talk about the affective and the bodily or behavioral. So would you start to distinguish that? Because I think the idea that the act of remembering lives on in some way really needs some elucidation there.
Yeah, right. Of course, yeah. So here's an example of what I call embodied Rilkean memories. It's where the act of remembering lives on in the form of a certain kind of behavioral tendency. So I think from my own case, this is another one of those other events that got me thinking about this. For various sort of, you know, reasons I won't bore you with, I spent a lot of my life running. And in recent years, I sort of started suffering from tears in my calf muscles, which is annoying because they take a long time to heal. So one day I was fortunate enough to meet a running coach, and I asked him about this, and he said, well, let me see you run. Let's look at your gait. And I did. He said, well, you're not lifting your knees high enough. Lift your knees higher, then more of the strain will be borne by your quads, which, being bigger muscles, are better able to handle the stress. And so I did that. I sort of dutifully went about changing my running style, lifting my knees higher. And then I was sort of immediately beset by a host of knee problems. And then I sort of remembered, you know, something I'd forgotten, that I used to have all these knee problems, and I realized that probably what had happened is that my running style had adjusted itself over the years to mitigate the sort of problems with my knees that I was having. So this sort of very unusual low knee lift was an attempt to sort of mitigate the problems with my knees. That was the point I remembered in the traditional sense, that I had had issues with my knees. But the idea is that the memory lived on in a different form. It lived on in my style of running, in the peculiar sort of gait that I had evolved into.
And so that one of the things so that's kind of the blood that you're talking about with Rilke, that the memory, the act of remembering, even though the content had been lost, had lived on in a behavioral disposition in a way that you ran, correct?
That's right, yeah.
And one of the things that leads us into one of the things that you want to distinguish this from in the book, and it's distinct from what sometimes people call bodily memory.
Yes, yeah. It's a form of bodily memory, but bodily memory can mean lots of different things. Talk of mental processes being embodied is very fashionable now, but as with all fashionable things, it comes to take on many forms. So the idea is not that my running style was a cause of my memories or caused by my memories. The thesis is that running style was a kind of memory. So it's identical with a certain sort of memory that I call a Rilkean memory. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. And I just want to ask you to then also expand a little bit on the other kind of act of remembering that you think gets transformed into Rilkean memories, and those are that's the affective side of things.
Yes, certain Rilkean memories don't take the form of behavioral dispositions. They take the form of moods or emotions or other sorts of affective states. So here's an example, another thing that got me thinking. A few years ago, I was invited to speak at this thing called the Hay Festival of Literature. So it's a literary festival in Britain, and well-known. But the best thing of all for me was that it was where I grew up, about 30 miles away from where I'd grown up as a kid. And my parents had moved away when I was 18, and so, you know, between one thing and another, I hadn't been back to that part of the world for over 30 years. And, you know, we all went over the summer. The whole family came, including the family dog, Hugo. And one day I found myself running along the River Wye, and something felt very right about it, as if this was sort of meant to be. And it was sort of very puzzling because I wasn't in very good shape at the time, and things don't normally feel right on runs when that's the case. But I worked it out a few days later. You know, that's how it would have been when I was a kid. I'd have been running along the banks of a river, the river on one side of me, the hills on the other side, and a dog running next to me. That's exactly what I would have been doing when I was a kid. So I think that sort of feeling of rightness, or this is the sense that this is the way things should be, was a kind of memory of childhood. And if so, that would be one example of an effective Rilkean memory, a memory that's transformed into a mood.
Yeah, would you expand on that a little bit? Because the mood part of this description was interesting most to me. And so could you give maybe another example of a kind of a mood that might be the act of remembering living on once, even after the content itself is gone?
Well, you can imagine sort of standard cases where someone has a phobia of something because of an event that occurred in their childhood, say, and they don't understand why they're scared of this thing, whether it's spiders or snakes or something like that, but they are. And the reason is that they once had a memory of something bad happening. The memory is gone, but it's now transformed into something else, into a mood or a fear of some sort.
Okay. So both of those, then, this idea that there could be behavioral dispositions and there can kind of be moods or other affective things, those do, if they do, live on in an act of remembering and a transformation of it. That does start to get to the idea that this is part of how our memories make us who we are, because both behavioral dispositions and affective kinds of things, we do typically consider to be part of who we are.
Yes, yeah, exactly right. So if we go back to the analogy of the book again, so you've got all these sentences that are redacted, these other sentences that remain are in various stages, in various degrees inaccurate. But there's a certain kind of style that pervades the writing, and that's what helps hold the book together in the absence of content. So these behavioral dispositions and these affective states, they contribute to a sort of style that a person has, the style of a person. I think that's what I was detecting in Patsy Hassett in his later years when he had Alzheimer's. There's a certain style that remained even in the face of these vast loss of memory content.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is philosopher Mark Rowlands, author of Memory and the Self, Phenomenology, Science, and Autobiography. I just want to take up another aspect of your argument here in the book. It's in the subtitle, Phenomenology. I think if you start to talk about what phenomenology is, you talk in the book a little bit about a misunderstanding, kind of a Western analytic approach that misunderstands what phenomenology is about. So if you'd explain that and then tie it into the argument you're making.
Yes. So the misunderstanding, as I see it anyway, is that in the sort of analytic tradition of philosophy, the tradition in which I grew up, phenomenology has basically been equated with the sort of study of experiences. You describe your experiences. I think that's you know, completely wrong, mistaken. Phenomenology is about what makes experience possible, the structures of the mind that allow us to experience the world in sort of certain ways. What phenomenology begins with are appearances, the way things appear. But the goal is always to work back from those appearances to how the mind must be if the appearances are to be the way they are.
And how does that tie into the structure of your argument? How do you make use of that broadly?
Well, it sort of surfaces in various ways. So particularly, it sort of emerges most clearly later in the book when I'm talking about the idea of the content of memory. Because the idea is that in memory, a past episode is presented to you in a certain way. It's presented to you as something that you once witnessed or experienced or orchestrated or otherwise encountered. And the idea is, well, if that's the way the episode is to appear to you, certain things often have to be done to the episode to make it appear in this way. So the mind has to do certain things precisely so the episode can appear to you as one that you formerly witnessed. So there's an example I talk about towards the end of the book. It's an example that unfortunately requires me to reveal my age, because it involves my father when I was a very young, a baby essentially. This was the morning of this was in the UK, so it would have been the morning of April the 26th, 1965. The time when Cassius Clay, as he then was fighting Sonny Liston, the second fight. And I remember this episode in a certain way. The episode involves certain transformations that my father's face underwent. This was a result of certain sort of unfortunate things happening. Apparently what happened is that I'd woken up and I needed milk or something like that, and making milk for a baby in those days was a long, sort of convoluted affair. You had to put it in a saucepan and stick it on an oven top and so on and so on. But he had to do that to basically keep me quiet. So there he must have been in the kitchen while this fight was being broadcast on TV. And the fight was over within about 100 seconds or so. So by the time he got back into the room with my warm milk, the fight was over. And I remember his face, transforming initially initially there was like confusion, what's going on. His eyes were flitting back and forth between me and the TV screen. Confusion slowly transformed to suspicion. Is that it? Is that really over? Have I missed the fight? And looking at me as if I'd done something to the TV and so on. Eventually, to sort of resigned acceptance. Oh yes, I've missed the fight. And then finally, some sort of happiness, because he was a big fan of Ali, or Clay as he then was. But the sort of salient feature, for my purposes at least, of that memory is of the face I remember transforming in this way. I remember it as the face of my father, but when this fight occurred, my dad would have been, in his mid-30s. But the face I remember transforming from confusion to suspicion to acceptance to joy was the face of an old man, the face he wore in his sort of final years. And so the question I had was, why would I have to remember it like that? And the answer lies in something that I think anyone who's grown up in the selfie age will find difficult to believe, but there weren't many photographs around in those days. I mean, making a photograph was a long, sort of drawn-out affair, which involved using a camera that often didn't work very well, accidentally exposing the film when you took it out, taking it down to the pharmacist who sent it away to get it developed. About 3 weeks later, you would get your photos back. So most of the time, we didn't bother. And so photographs of my father would have been few and far between. And so what would have happened if the face I remember transforming in this way was the face of my father in his mid-30s? There's a significant chance that I wouldn't have recognized the face. And so in order to make that episode, the episode of my father's face transforming in certain ways, in order for me to experience that episode as one that I formerly witnessed, his face had to be altered to be a face that I would recognize as the face of my father. So the idea is that the content of our memories, they always have our sort of fingerprints on them. So we're in the content of our memories in the sense that we have to do things to them in order to make them precisely the content.
That's an interesting idea, and one of the interesting distinctions, I think, in the book, maybe goes against a kind of common idea of remembering. I think the idea of remembering is that the content is just kind of picked out accurately. We draw it in, and we see it like on a visual screen. But you're arguing here that the remembering is actually more of a kind of at least selective, but even creative process.
It's a creative process, yeah. And this in recent years, you know, has been sort of confirmed by some groundbreaking work done in the neurosciences by people such as Karen Nader and colleagues. Think of it in terms of Plato had this metaphor of the wax, right, which I think dominated the way we tended to think about memory. So when a memory is first formed or encoded, as it's put, an imprint is made in the wax. And then the wax hardens, which corresponds to the transition from short-term to long-term memory, and then it exists in as a sort of stable trace imprinted in the wax. And what the sort of developments in the neuroscience have shown over the last 20 years or so, I think, is that model has got to be rejected. If we want to think in terms of a sort of wax model, then we would have to amend it in this way. Every time you remember, the wax needs to soften again. And when it becomes soft again, then certain things can be done to memories, certain transformations, certain alterations can be made into them. The neuroscience I'm talking about involved the realization that accessing memories involved the same kind of neurobiological processes as forming them or encoding them in the first place. So when you form or encode a memory, certain sort of structures have to be built. Certain dendritic connections between the dendrites, for example, have to be established. Or maybe certain ion channels have to be built, and things like that. And these involve very rapid protein synthesis. So when you encode a memory, you need protein synthesis. What Nader and colleagues basically showed is that, at least in the case of rats, when you access memories, the same kind of protein synthesis is required. So what do you do? They showed this by basically injecting a protein synthesis inhibitor into rats, and their memories of various things just disappeared. And this loss was not sort of temporary. It wasn't as if it only occurred while the rats were under the influence of the protein synthesis inhibitor. The memories were gone permanently. So why would this be? Why would you need protein synthesis when you access or recall memories? It's because you're building new structures. And so this sort of process became known as reconsolidation. The original process of the wax sort of hardening was called consolidation. And so this process of building new structures and so on when memories are accessed became known as reconsolidation. And so the kind of story I tell about the content of memory fits very nicely with this kind of story of reconsolidation.
Right. So when we form the memories, just to summarize, when we form the memories, there's a neuroscientific basis for it. And then when we recall them, the same thing is happening. So that really opens it up to reformulating, altering, recreating the memory, and it introduces the possibility of changes happening.
That's correct, yeah. That's exactly right.
Okay, and I need to ask you to distinguish something here that you've just mentioned. The main kind of memory that you're talking about here is what's called episodic memory, and it's often distinguished from semantic memory. Could you just, you don't need to get all the way into that distinction. People can get the book and read about it if they're interested in that. But if you'd at least start to clarify episodic memory and why it particularly is important.
Right, yeah. No, the episodic semantic memory distinction was originally drawn by a guy called Endel Tulving. And the basic idea is that semantic memories are memories of facts. You know, you remember that Paris is the capital of France and things like that. That's semantic memory. But episodic memory is memory of episodes that you have formerly encountered, things that you did or things that you witnessed. So it's memory of sort of certain episodes in the past which are remembered precisely as episodes in the past.
And it's important for your discussion here because of this quality of them, what you call presence of self in memory. It's the episodic memories that really have this sense of a self in them.
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, there's a lot of confusion, and not a lot of work has been done on what exactly is remembered in an episodic memory. So some people say, well, look, to remember episodically, to have an episodic memory is just to remember episodes. But that doesn't seem enough, because I can remember episodes non-episodically. I can remember the Vesuvius erupted in 79 AD. That was a memory of an episode. The episode was an eruption of a volcano. But that's not episodic memory. So it's more to it than simply remembering an episode. So others say, well, no, okay, what it is memory of experiences you formerly had. There's also a problem with that idea, though, because there is this phenomenon known as perspective switching, which seems to happen to a lot of our episodic memories. Estimates range between 30 and 70%. So the idea is something like this. Suppose you have a memory, say, of falling out of a tree when you were 10 years old or something like that. You remember it, and in fact you did fall out of a tree when you were 10 years old, but you remember it now from a perspective you couldn't have had at the time. You remember it from a perspective of an observer seeing you fall out of the tree. That's known as perspective switching. You're adopting a new perspective, a perspective you couldn't have had at the time. So if perspective switching is real, and there's a lot of evidence in favor of it, then it seems in that sort of case you are remembering experiences that you couldn't have had at the time. You're remembering visual experiences and so on that you could not have had at the time the episode occurred. So I think to reconcile this idea, we need both the idea of an episode and also the idea of experience. And the way I reconcile the two ideas is that when we episodically remember, we remember an episode, but this episode must be presented in a certain experiential way. It must be presented as something you formerly encountered. And that's the defining feature of episodic memory. An episode is presented as one you formerly encountered in the sense of orchestrated or witnessed or otherwise experienced. So that's my view of episodic memory anyway.
And a key component of that for your overall argument here in terms of establishing a view of memory, these Rilkean memories that can provide a basis of self, is that in those episodic memories is this presence of self, that the self is, it's not even added to it, it's really just there.
Yeah, you're present in all your memories, even when your memories are not about you. You're present in your episodic memories in the sense that the episode you're remembering is presented to you, or you experience it as one that you formerly encountered. So that's what I mean by the presence of self in memory. You're present in your memories in the sense that the thing you remember it as something that formerly happened to you.
Right, and that's important to this whole project, because that's what you're kind of going for here, is how these memories can constitute a self.
Yes, that exactly right. Yeah. So if we return once again to the book, you know, we've got this book of you that is largely redacted, contains lots of false and misleading sentences amongst those that remain. The idea is. The idea would be, well, how can that be a book of you? Or if we switch the analogy, suppose some alien intelligence was able to form a sort of precise visual record of your entire life. All the things you see in the course of your life is sort of put down in the form of this huge collage of pictures. And, you know, together the pictures more or less tell a kind of story that would be intelligible. But then someone comes along and starts lifting the pictures out of the collage, and most of the pictures are removed by this person, and the ones that remain, this person alters or defaces them in various ways. Then the idea is, the collage now is just sort of unintelligible. It should make no sense at all. There's no sort of coherence or unity to it anymore. So that is kind of like the position we find ourselves given the enormous amount of forgetting of our memories and the sort of the falsity of the memories that remain. The idea is that thinking about it this way, building up a person from all these little individual pieces, is not the right way to think of it. The individual pieces, you sort of are in those individual pieces, is the idea. And that's where the coherence and the unity of a life comes from. So it's not as if we have these, it's not like a collage, ultimately, in the sense that a collage contains pictures that could, in principle, go in any collage. But in your collage, the collage of your life, the pictures are all, they have your sort of metaphorical fingerprints all over them.
And what happens in the transformation of this act of remembering, even though the content disappears or dims or something at least, in the transformation to these Rilkean memories, that continues to live on. That presence of self, that sense of self is what is sustained.
Yeah, if we go back to the memory of my father's face, my fingerprints are on that memory in the sense that I had to transform it from the face he actually had when this episode occurred to the face that I could remember as the face of my father. So I am in that memory in no sense. I had to transform and reconstruct that memory precisely so it would appear to me as something I once witnessed. That's the basic idea. So I'm in that memory in that sense. That memory has my metaphorical fingerprints on it in that sense.
Right. You've talked about this book of you that is a metaphor you use in the book, and it brings up another aspect of part of your argument here, and it's in the subtitle, this idea of autobiography. So if you would maybe just talk about that briefly. I'm going to go ahead after you do that. I'm probably going to open up the phone lines and see if we have some listeners that might like to call in so people can kind of get ready for that. But if you'd introduce this idea of autobiography and how it's relevant here.
Yeah, the notion of autobiography, it's basically a way of trying to make clear what kind of account of the self I'm after. Because there is a view of the self and personal identity that you find in this certain sorts of philosophy where you're interested in highly technical questions like what are the identity and persistence conditions for a person. So what makes a person who exists at a certain time T the same person as a person who exists at time T1, and things like this. And there is a sort of well-defined program in philosophy concerned with precisely those sorts of questions. I call that the metaphysical self. And I sort of explain that I'm not interested in the metaphor, in the metaphysical self. I'm interested in what I call the autobiographical self. And the initial way of making clear what I'm interested in is just, you know, in terms of, well, suppose you were to write an autobiography, a book about your life, you know, a detailed accounting of the life you've lived, the things you've seen, the choices you've made, and so on and so on. That book of you, that autobiography, it wouldn't be concerned with things like identity and persistence conditions for persons, unless it was a very strange autobiography. So the idea is that the autobiographical self, the self I'm interested in, is self-contained in the book of you. It's what the book of you is about.
Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is philosopher Mark Rowlands. He's the author of Memory and the Self, Phenomenology, Science, and Autobiography. If you've got any questions for him and questions about memory, about the self and the relationship between memory and the self, this is the opportunity to give us a call at 707-895-2448, and we'll take your calls here. This idea about the philosophical metaphysical project brings up another issue that I think it's just a point of clarification, perhaps. You say you're not particularly interested in that for this book. And it goes back to the phenomenological idea of developing this argument and kind of bracketing those metaphysical questions. Could you expand on that maybe while we're waiting just a little bit to see if somebody calls in?
Sure, yeah. So one way of thinking about this autobiography that you're writing. Another reason why I got interested in this in the first place is because I've written a couple of sort of autobiographies or memoirs at least, and I sort of had to reconcile that with what I know about memory, you know. But this sort of autobiography that you're writing, it's not interested in the sorts of metaphysical questions that philosophers often ask about the self. What makes this self the same self through time? What makes this self a different self from any other self, and so on? The book of you, you might say, looking at it through a phenomenological lens, the book of you brackets those sorts of questions. We start off with basically appearances, and the appearances in this case are the things that happen to you in your life, the experiences you've had and the memories you you have of them. So that was a fairly shallow sense of phenomenological. That was just a, you know, but that's not the main phenomenological thrust of the book.
Right. We do have a call coming in. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
My name is Bo.
Bo, go ahead.
I've recently discovered the work of Douglas Hofstadter, and I was wondering if Mr. Rowland, if his work has been influenced by Douglas Hofstadter or any of his derivatives.
Ah, good question. I read Hofstadter a long, long time ago. So I would say that as far as I know, it's not been influenced by his work, but who knows? That's the thing about influence. You never really know what seeps in because you don't remember what you've read. So it's quite possible, you know, the certain sort of ideas seeped in. I just don't remember enough of what I read of his work to be able to say, yes, he did.
Okay, thanks. Once again, if you've got a question about memory in the self, please give us a call at 895-2448 and ask your questions of Professor Rowlands. I want to ask you to expand on another part of the argument. Well, I've got another call, so I'm going to go ahead and take that. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Chat,
go ahead.
I don't really remember what I called about. Anyway, like one of the things that happened to me personally is that it's been a while that I keep writing down like my thought and my everything that sort of importantly happened to my life and small events. So the idea of writing it down is to make sure that you like have more database, you remember more accurately. So the conscience of a person seems to me continue to question the memory. So it's actually like memory is considered as, at least for me, not a very significant part of my life or actually sometimes damaging because you already know that sometimes you remember the wrong thing or you try to, you know, sort of like do your wishful thinking with your memory. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of the self that is really not necessarily determined by memory, but the checking of the memory. So it seems to me that there's a bigger part that makes the self of a person than just a memory. I think that's what I'm going to say.
Okay, great. We'll get Mark to respond. Thanks.
Yeah, no, the idea that memories are the only things that make you who you are, I think, is not right at all. It's certainly not one I'd want to endorse. I mean, one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is to show how these other things that wouldn't be recognized typically as memories, things that result from the sort of degeneration of memories, these can also play an important role in shaping who we are. So it's memories that have basically gone and become transformed into something else. They play a very significant role in helping make us who we are. But so you said something at the beginning about writing down your memories, and that's actually another thing that Ulrich Neisser and Nicole Haar showed in another study was the importance of that kind of externalization of memories for fixing memories. So they did a study of there was an earthquake in the San Francisco Bay Area, I think in the early 90s. And they did a similar kind of study of that as the Challenger study. Under certain conditions, they discovered that memories can become sort of fixed and quite reliable. And those kind of memories are the memories where you're constantly repeating them to someone else. And writing, I mean, either speaking or writing would presumably accomplish the same sort of function. So think about an earthquake. If you're a student who's several thousand miles away from home and there's an earthquake, the whole of your family and friends are going to want to know what you were doing when the earthquake happened. And so you repeat this over and over and over again. And apparently that fixes the memory. So some students in Berkeley could remember exactly what they were doing 3 years before when the earthquake struck, even though they hadn't even noticed the earthquake striking.
Interesting stuff. Another call coming in. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name?
Robin.
Robin, go ahead.
Yes, the last caller, I think, I turned off the radio, but I was thinking about, this could be called selective memory when something traumatic happens and you don't want to be responsible for it. And so you have to believe that it happened a certain way, and then, of course, other people say, no, we witnessed it, and it's, no,
yes, yes,
you're
no,
wrong. That's
Nietzsche,
what happened, and
this,
it's fixated, and sometimes
I did that, said my memory.
It's best to just
I got you both
alone.
Talking here. Hold on a second.
Oh, sorry, sorry, my apologies.
No, sorry, go ahead. Go ahead, Robin, finish up.
Yes, I was just saying that sometimes it's best to leave it alone if you're in conflict with someone who believes one, this happened this way, and you know it happened the other way. You must release, because otherwise I think that what you're doing is trying to protect yourself from possible, you know, that you possibly were complicit in whatever happened.
Right.
Is, I mean, I'm just putting that out. I don't know. I was just thinking about an episode.
As a strategy for dealing with someone else, that might well be, that might well be right. I mean, but Nietzsche had this, he wrote this little aphorism which goes like this: I did that, said my memory. I cannot have done that, says my pride. Eventually, memory relents. we do that. Part of what's going on, I think, in that sort of, with that sort of phenomenon, is that it's to do with the usefulness of memories. Memories basically are things, the ability to remember is something we've evolved, and as such, it sort of has to earn its keep. And often, as John LeDoux, one of the neuroscientists who studied this sort of phenomenon, once noted, it's often far less important to have accurate representations or recall of the past than it is to have things that are useful for your current goals in the present. And so that's one of the reasons we sort of amend our memories. We amend them in certain ways, sometimes at least, that makes them useful to what we're doing now. So going back yet again to the metaphor of the book, you thought you were writing an autobiography, a sort of accurate recounting of your life as you've lived it, but you keep switching genres, you keep switching, well, there's some overzealous editor, let's suppose, that keeps switching genres and tries to convert your book into a self-help book. And it turns out that you're the editor.
I got another call coming in. Hi there, may I have your first name, please?
Tom.
Tom, go ahead.
Well, I was just wondering, is there a physiological difference between a good memory and a bad memory? I mean, is it even detectable? I mean, is there, I don't know, I guess that's my question. I just wonder if different memories have different effects on your brain.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. No, there isn't really. I mean, from purely looking at the sort of the neurobiology of it, it's the same whether the memories are accurate or not. I mean, there's nothing you could look at neurobiologically and say, oh, yeah, that's a good memory, oh, that's not. It's being a good memory is or a bad memory is a sort of relational property. It all depends on how it relates to the past. And there's nothing sort of intrinsic to the neurobiological structures or processes that can indicate whether it does. So a good versus think of a good memory as being like a sort of grandfather. There's nothing intrinsic to a person that makes them a grandfather. It's relations to other things that makes them a grandfather. A good memory or a bad memory is basically like that.
Next call. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Steve.
Steve, go ahead.
Quick question. The role of technology, as far as the younger generation goes, doesn't seem to need to have to really remember anything. Can you comment on the role of technology over, let's say, the past 20 years or so? And I'll take my answer on the air. Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks,
Steve. Yes, no, it's a great question. I could spend all day talking about it, actually. But I think technology, really, from the point of view of memory, technology started, though, not 20 years ago, but 10,000 years ago. No, a little less than that. Several thousand years ago, when certain cultures started becoming literate, because writing basically is an external store of memory. So you imagine, say, an envoy of some tribal chief. On the one hand, they don't have any sort of system of writing. That envoy has to remember word for word the message of the tribal chief. Contrast that with someone who has a sort of basic form of writing, say, in a system of knots. All they need to remember is the code that allows them to interpret the knots, right? So once you've got an external form of memory storage, writing being the earliest example, certain aspects of your memory become less important. And so you find that sort of the outstanding natural memory of pre-literate cultures, you know, they can remember songs that last for six nights kind of thing, you know. We can't get anywhere near that anymore because our memory has basically changed, and this is a kind of hardware change in our memory. We've sort of distributed our memories out onto the world, so we have to do less with our brains. What our brain becomes is basically what it has to do now is remember the code that allows you to plug into these external stores of memory. What we're seeing, in the last 10, 20 years is basically a kind of natural extension, I think, of that. So, you know, we're all lost without our iPhones now, you know, because we can't remember anything at all. It's not entirely clear that's our memory getting worse, but it is clear that our memory is changing fundamentally.
Well, another aspect of this, you didn't write about it in the book particularly, but I just wonder if you've got any thoughts about it in terms of technology. It seems to me that since the advent of modern computer technology, the overriding metaphor for memory and brain is a computer model, like memory is something like a hard drive. And those kinds of metaphors for this whole area of memory and self really creep in, often unannounced.
They do. I suppose each age has its own preferred metaphor for the mind. You know, when we're in the Victorian age, it was like a sort of steam engine and so on. But now it's a computer. But the computer model is false in many ways. And memory is a good example. It's nothing like a file at all. I mean, it would be like a computer file if the file had to be converted from hard to software in order to sort of access it. But it's not like that at all. Memories are very, very different. I think at least that's what the neuroscience seems to indicate.
One other thing that one of the callers kind of alluded to that I'd like you to talk about just briefly, and there's a lot more in the book that we're not going to be able to get to. We are running down to the end of the program. Let me just announce again that this is Consider This. My guest is Mark Rowlands. The book is Memory and the Self, Phenomenology, Science, and Autobiography. So just this idea of forgetting. We do forget an awful lot of memory. You make an interesting point in the book that the very forgetting can be part of this transformation into a Rilkean memory that actually becomes part of who we are. The forgetting can be part of it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, forgetting is often random, but sometimes forgetting can be something you do on purpose. And you find sort of analogs of this at the level of cultures and so on. Cultures condition themselves to forget certain things because the memories are sort of too painful. So you could think, if it's possible to think of memories in terms of strategy, sort of forgetting in terms of strategy, you know, that is something that would be a very kind of important component of who you are. If there's a certain sort of style of forgetting or a certain strategy for forgetting that you've adopted precisely because you don't want to remember certain things, then this says at least as much about you as the things you've forgotten.
Well, we are getting down to the very end of the program, Mark. I really appreciate your being here. Again, the book is Memory and the Self, Phenomenology, Science, and Autobiography. I'd like to invite you to sum up or give us any final thoughts about the book and anything you'd like to leave my listeners with.
I have no final thoughts, really. Okay. I think we've covered things very, very comprehensively, actually. Stuart, you did a great job. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. philosopher Mark Rowlands, author Memory in the Self, Phenomenology, Science, and Autobiography. Mark, thanks very much for being on the program. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Stu. Thank you very much, Pat.
Bye-bye.